Well, welcome. The sign-up sheet is going around as usual, and some of you may be in Mr. Brummett's class. He asked me to make sure that you signed in, and I'll get a copy of the sign-up sheet so you can get extra credit. So I want to introduce our speaker for this afternoon. Professor Marchetti is a teacher here in the English department. He's in the IPS literature program, and he will be talking to us today about introductions and conclusions. His talk is titled, Beginning with the End in Mind, Advice for Writing Engaging Introductions and Conclusions. That's welcome, Mr. Marchetti.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome. Glad that you're here. Let me begin by saying that introductions and conclusions are probably some of the most difficult parts of writing an essay. Would you agree? But what I hope to show you today is that they can be among the most pleasant. And so if we can think under the aspect of aesthetic, then hopefully we can really have an appreciation for what we're doing here today. What I anticipate doing is walking through these notes with you. They're quite detailed, but I wanted to make sure that you can carry away the important information with you and to reconsider it and maybe even use it as a guideline for writing your essays in the future. But if you do have a pressing question, simply raise your hand in the air. I'm happy to pause and address it. Otherwise, we'll just save any questions that you may have towards the end. Edward Bowles is a cognitive psychologist, an educational theorist, and he famously said, "We remember what we understand only what we pay attention to, and we pay attention to what we want." And what I find fascinating about this quote is that if you think about it, it's actually the structural components of an essay in reverse. Because the reality that humans pay attention only to what they want to is the burden of an introduction. You have to motivate your reader's interest in your thesis. The second phrase in that quote, "We understand only what we pay attention to," is the burden of the body of your argument for an essay. In that part of your essay, your responsibility as a writer is to help your reader understand your thesis through a logical argument. And in the first part of that statement, "We remember what we understand," is the essence of a good conclusion for an academic essay, that you want to preserve in your reader's memory your concluding notion, its relevance, as well as further possibilities for using it in other readings of the text. So the first point that I want to argue today, and this may be new to you, unfamiliar, perhaps even shocking, is that you need to understand how your reader commonly processes information, prioritizing and retaining more of what she or he experiences firstly and lastly. You've probably come across cognitive psychology that has told us that people tend to remember more what they hear at the beginning or at the end, and they tend to lose from memory what they hear in the middle. That shows that your introduction and your conclusion, though they may be shorter in your essays, do have exaggerated importance for your reader. So, first impressions matter. Determining the extent of your reader's interested engagement with your essay. Harold Bloom titled one of his books, "Where Shall Wisdom Be Found?" And that's really a good question to consider in your introduction, because we here at UD, we seek to love wisdom, yes? And you are a human writing for other humans about humane texts to help them gain a further understanding and appreciation for them. And so you may think about that as kind of a generalized question of setting a tone of expectation in your introduction. Second, final impressions matter. Demanding the scope of your reader's ongoing engagement with your essay. One of the privileges of writing a literary analysis of a text is that you are able to motivate your reader's ongoing engagement with that very text. And so Francis Schaeffer asked, "How shall we then live?" And of course, in the humanities, in a liberal arts education, that is one of the pressing questions, is how do these texts assist us in understanding who we are as human beings and the ways that we should live. Now, Aristotle in his Politics famously said, "Well begun is half done." And of course, he's describing the development of a polis, but he could have been talking about the crafting of an essay. And so what I want to argue is that you need to compose your essay in an effective order. Most of the time, you've probably sat down at your laptop or taken out a pencil and paper, and you start to write an essay by starting to write an introduction. That would make a certain logical kind of sense. But I want to argue that you're not prepared to write your introduction until the very end of the compositional endeavor. So I want to reflect in order that would be quite different. It might be counterintuitive to you at first, but perhaps suspend judgment and hear me out. Firstly, write the body of your essay in order to develop and defend your logical argument regarding your thesis. I think you have to write the body of your argument first because you don't know what you know until you write it out. You don't know if the thesis that you've come up with will stand the burden of interpretation until you write out your argument of it and consider counter-arguments against it. And so you have to write out the body of your argument first so that you know what you know and you can anticipate the direction that you're taking your reader. Next then, write the conclusion of your essay so that you have in mind the culminating notion that you present to your reader. And you can only get to that culminating notion after you've written your thesis and written the body of your argument. Lastly then, you're in the position to write the introduction of your essay, connecting your reader's interest to the relevance of your specific interpretive claim, that which we call a thesis about a particular text. Does that make a certain kind of sense to you? Okay. Jesus then says in the Gospels, so the last will be first and the first last, and if we ripped it out of context, we could say he could have been talking about introductions and conclusions. And so what I want to do now is to consider how to write a conclusion, assuming that you've already written your thesis, written the body of your argument, developing and defending that thesis, now you're in a position to craft your conclusion. So you want to craft the salient components of the conclusion, manifesting a kind of staying power in your reader's mind. That's the burden of a conclusion, is it has to have a kind of staying power in your reader's mind. In your conclusion, you move from the specific to the general. So I want us to think in terms of an equilateral triangle, which I did my best to draw on the whiteboard here for you. Firstly, state the solution to the problem, or perhaps the answer to the question that you frame in your thesis. Your thesis should present some kind of problem that you have discovered in the text that demands a solution. Or you can frame it as a question, either implicit or explicit in the text, that demands an appropriate answer. I suggest that you should place this concluding notion in the stress position of the first topic sentence in your concluding paragraph, giving it rhetorical emphasis for your reader. This succinct statement about your culminating argument is the weightiest sentence in your essay, so compose it under extraordinary attention. I tell my students all the time that when I pick up their essay, it should fold and sag just at that place of their concluding notion, because it should have that kind of weight and merit. After all, it ought to be the most memorable part of your essay, lingering in your reader's mind, whether or not she agrees or perhaps disagrees with it. In other words, if someone were to ask your reader, "What is this essay about?" then your reader should be able to state your concluding notion. It should be that clear, it should be that memorable for your reader to hold in mind. Next, you want to describe the abiding relevance of your thesis, showing why it matters for two things. First, for a better understanding of the text as a reader. Remember, you're writing as a reader for another reader about a certain text, engaging in literary discourse about that text. But more broadly, especially because you're writing as a human to a human being, you want to write suggesting a better way of living that the text suggests, drawing out its wider and more generalized implications. In other words, address the implicit question in your reader's mind after she or he has read your essay, and that is, so what? Lastly then, finesse your concluding notion by gesturing towards more about which you wonder in view of your literary analysis of the text under its relative aspect. To say it another way, draw your reader's attention to further possibilities or perhaps expanding implications that the cumulative argument of your essay suggests. Take your reader back into the text, leaving her or him there as a way to show your proper regard for its authority, or we could say its beauty, its truth. By so doing, you give the author the last word, so to say, sounding an echo that reverberates in your reader's mind. I would suggest that you have written a really excellent essay if your reader is motivated to read more of the text that you're interpreting. I think that that's a good test for its persuasion. In sum, be text-centered yet audience-focused. Text-centered means that the authority of your interpretation must be proven from the text itself. Audience-focused means that you're doing it with an aim to your reader. And that includes the relevance aspect as well as taking them back into the text for further understanding of its meaning. Having read your essay then, your reader should be intellectually challenged, emotionally inspired, aesthetically appreciative, and perhaps even ethically guided. Now, one thing that we should maybe have as a warning, and this is an all too common tendency, I think, among perhaps rookie writers, is that in your conclusion, resist the temptation merely to paraphrase your thesis and argument in a repetitive manner. Don't just restate in a condensed summary paraphrase your thesis and the body of your argument. That's not an adequate conclusion. So what we have here is the most specific point of your essay, and that is the concluding notion. Again, the concluding notion is the solution to the problem framed by your thesis, or if you frame it as a question, then the concluding notion is its answer that you're suggesting. Then you demonstrate the relevance of this concluding notion for your reader, both for their reading of the text and human living more generally. And then the last thing you want to do is redirect your reader's attention back towards the text, showing how your concluding notion has further implications for additional reading of the text. In other words, it's expanding possibilities. Now, I've selected here a conclusion from Marilynne Robinson. She's one of my most treasured authors. She's the one who I intend to write my dissertation on. And she has a marvelous essay in her collection of essays called The Death of Adam. And she's writing about Psalm 8. And this is what she says. What is eternal must always be complete, if my understanding is correct. Now that statement, what is eternal must always be complete, that's her concluding notion. Is that memorable? I suggest it is. It is succinct, it is condensed, it's concentrated, but it's a very weighty statement. So it is possible to imagine that time was created in order that there might be narrative, event, sequence and causation, ignorance and error, retribution, atonement. Does this suggest the relevance of her notion? As a literature student, I love it. The idea that the Creator made creation in time and space for the sake of narrative. A word, a phrase, a story falls on rich or stony ground and flourishes as it can. Possibility in a sleeve of limitation. Certainly time is the occasion for our strangely mixed nature, in every moment differently compounded, so that often we surprise ourselves and always scarcely know ourselves and exist in relation to experience. If we attend to it, and if its plainness does not disguise it from us, as if we were visited by revelation. That last statement, as if we were visited by revelation, shows her religious perspective on the Bible, that she sees it as a kind of divine revelation that humans can attend to. And by doing so, what is she doing? She's redirecting her reader's attention to the text, suggesting further consideration of its importance and how we would read Psalm 8 and the Bible more comprehensively. Does that make sense? I'll pause here. Any thoughts or questions so far? Let me continue then. Samuel Palmer in 1740 collected moral essays on Proverbs, and he said, "A good beginning makes a good end. 'Tis a great point of wisdom to begin at the right end." And that is why I argue that you compose your introduction last, because now you're prepared to do so. In other words, you've given your reader a thesis that has been developed in a body of argument, right? And you know where you've taken them in the conclusion. Now you're prepared to introduce them to it. So craft the salient components of an introduction that evoke your reader's interest in the relevance of your thesis. Probably the greatest vice, if we could say it that way, of so many introductions to essays is that they are boring and they do not motivate the reader's attention. It is the responsibility of the writer to motivate the reader's interest in the thesis. How do you do that? Remember this relevance that you've already written in your conclusion? You borrow this compositional capital to use it for motivating your reader's interest. Because what is relevant to them ought to be interesting to them, right? So that's what I'm arguing. So importantly, set the tone of your essay here, keying your reader's ear by means of the diction you use. In other words, what is the most befitting tone for the essay that you're writing? A more comedic tone, a more serious tone, a more emotional tone, a more intellectual tone? Is there going to be a moral tone that would be necessary? In your introduction, then, you move from the general to the specific. Think of the structure of an upside-down equilateral triangle, which I did not draw. Sorry. This should be upside down. I was so concerned in getting it right that I copied that. But imitation, as Aristotle tells us, is the essence of good art, right? Okay. Let's see if I can do this quickly. It should look like this. And obviously the correspondence between the thesis and the concluding notion is obvious. Firstly, motivate the problem or question framed by your thesis, putting pressure on it by asking the most appropriate kinds of questions that provoke the reader's interest. Questions are so effective because interrogative sentences rhetorically solicit, I would say even obligate, the reader's participation in immediate and heightened ways that declarative sentences do not. If you speak a declarative sentence to someone, they can remain completely disengaged from it. But the minute you ask an open question to someone, it automatically solicits, even obligates, their participation because they have to make a response to the question. They either have to ignore it, right? Or they have to consider it, or they have to answer it, right? I was just rereading this essay, Psalm 8, by Marilynne Robinson, and she says a beautiful thing about questions. She says, "A question is more spacious than a statement, far better suited to expressing wonder." And I think in a very generous way, as writers, we're motivating our readers' wonder. We're motivating their sense of possibility in the text that we are bringing before their attention, making interpretive claims about it as we do. Furthermore, then, remember the relevance of your conclusion, the concluding notion that you've already composed. And as I say, you're going to borrow from this compositional capital, using it to evoke the particular kind of interest that will connect your reader to your thesis. And I would say whatever content that your thesis has, whether it's a political consideration or psychological or ethical or aesthetic or intellectual or emotional, then those are the kinds of questions that you should use to motivate your reader's interest. Because there are different kinds of questions. There's probing questions. There's questions that are highly suggestive. There's questions that provoke wonder and speculation, right? So using the appropriate kind of question will be extremely helpful here. Next, then, show what is at stake in the struggle for finding a text-based solution to your identified problem, or alternatively, a text-based answer to your identified question. And let me give you three questions that you can use to consider what is at stake. First, what is at stake if one fails to find the correct solution to the problem or the correct answer to the question framed by your thesis? You can approach it from that angle. What happens when we as humans fail in this enterprise? Or what is at stake if one finds the incorrect solution or the incorrect answer framed by your thesis? What happens if we get it wrong? What's at stake? What are the consequences? Next, what is at stake if one finds the correct solution to the problem? This is the ideal situation. Or the correct answer to the question framed by my thesis. In other words, you can positively state, and I suggest that you do that, you positively state what the consequences would be for getting it right. After all, isn't that why you're writing the essay? Lastly, then, state your thesis or your interpretive claim as your proposed solution to the problem or as your proposed answer to the question, challenging your reader's initial agreement, disagreement, or uncertainty. Most frequently, place your thesis in the stress position of the last sentence in your introductory paragraph. Now, Dr. Romanek Baldwin will appreciate this quotation, but Saul Bellow famously tells this story of one of his compositional teachers who used to stand in front of her classroom, and she would borrow the tune from the Hallelujah Chorus. We're all familiar with that, right? Handel's Hallelujah Chorus. And she would stand before her class, and she would clap along, and she would sing, "Be specific, be specific, be specific, be specific, be specific, be specific." And I torture my students with my unpleasant rendering of that because I want that to echo in their minds as they're sitting in front of their computers or when they have pen to paper and they're crafting their thesis, because you need to be specific. The more specific you are, the clearer it will be in your reader's mind. In other words, a mist here is a fog there, right? If it's misty in your mind, it's going to be impenetrable fog to your reader. In sum, then, your introduction should generate your reader's anticipation of your argument that will follow in the body of your essay. In other words, your reader should want to read the remainder of your essay. How many of those kinds of essays have you and I read? Probably quite few. But this is the greatness of writing an introduction, to where your reader loses all sense of time and cannot wait to read the remainder of the essay. Because you have roused her or his intellectual curiosity, emotional tension, aesthetic wonder, and perhaps ethical dilemma. Now, there's another liability for an introduction, and again, this is the rookie error in composition. And that is, resist the temptation merely to paraphrase the text your essay considers. Richard Bosch, in his introduction to Eudora Welty's collection of essays on writing, tells about when he heard her speak. She was 86 years old, and she was speaking at an Episcopal church across from the Folger Shakespearean Library in Washington, D.C. And Eudora Welty told this story herself, that when she was invited to do a reading one time by a prominent library, the elder librarian requested that she tell one of her stories in her own words. Now, Miss Welty was very generous with that, but can you imagine asking a writer not to read their story, but to simply paraphrase it from themselves? How absurd is that, right? Well, in a similar way, your reader can read the text, so use paraphrase sparingly. Paraphrasing has its uses, but probably more in the body of your argument than in the introduction. Consider then Christopher Rick's introduction to his essay about Samuel Beckett. Now, how many of you know who Samuel Beckett is? Any hands? Anyone? A few. Maybe you're familiar with Waiting for Godot or one of his plays. I'm glad that you're not, because I want to share Professor Rick's introduction to Samuel Beckett, because what I want to show you is that he motivates your interest in Samuel Beckett. You have no need to know who Samuel Beckett is. Professor Rick says, "We know about our wish to go on being, we human beings, our wish not to die. Samuel Beckett, who rigged nothing, fashioned for himself and for us a voice, Malone's, at once wistful and wiry. Yes, there is no good pretending. It is hard to leave everything." Yes, there is no good pretending, says Ricks. It is hard to leave everything. These are the accents of a consciousness, imagining and imagined, which braves the immortal commonplace of mortality. Most people, most of the time, want to live forever. This truth is acknowledged in literature, including Beckett's. But like many a truth, it is a half-truth. Not half-true, but half of the truth, as is the truth of a proverb. For, after all, most people some of the time, and some people most of the time, do not want to live forever. This counter-truth, that on occasion and more than moodily, we want oblivion, extinction, irreversible loss of consciousness, is insufficiently, or is most, prophylactically rendered by literature. Authorities, sacred and secular, do not care for the thought. They do not want you to be dead, except perhaps as a martyr, and even this they have their doubts about. Yet who would maintain, through thick and thin, that the energy which is consciousness is eternal delight? Consciousness does not have to be pain to be a burden, or to be a perturbation of mind in endless prospect. After I read this to my Literary Tradition 1 class, one student couldn't help himself, and he burst out and said, "God, I wish I could write like that." And I feel the same way. Now, what I like about this conclusion is that he begins by showing the relevance of it, right? He connects it to the human condition. The fact that there's an aspect of us that wants to live forever, and yet there's equally an aspect of us at times that does not wish to do so, right? And then he raises a great question towards the end that really seals, for me anyway, my interest as a reader. Who would maintain through thick and thin that the energy which is consciousness is eternal delight? That question obligates my participation. And then he states a very clear thesis. Consciousness does not have to be pain to be a burden, or to be a perturbation of mind in endless prospect. That's his claim. That's his reading of Beckett. That's what I have for you today. Now I'd like to open it up for questions and discussion, maybe clarifications or challenges. Does anyone have anything? Yes, sir.
Yes, I was really interested about how much prominence you put on the question, especially as part of the introduction. So I've been steered in high school away from using question, leaving things open-ended, I guess. So would you have any advice for avoiding, I guess, the overuse or the misuse of questions?
Yeah, I think overuse can be a misuse. If all you do is put a sequence of one question after another, I think it overwhelms the reader. I think less is more. I think asking one or maybe two of the best questions in an introduction is excellent. Professor Ricks only asked one. I don't find that any other is missing. And so, again, understand how questions work. When a reader reads a question, you almost have to imagine that there's a pause that they need to experience, right? Because as Ms. Robinson has said, questions open up. They invite people into wonder and speculation. The second thing is, I think you can use the wrong kind of question. And again, there's a variety, and you could do some additional research on this, but consider the kind of question that is most likely to motivate your reader's interest in your thesis. And I think you have to take your thesis under consideration to anticipate how the reader would most be interested in it. Is it going to be an intellectual claim that your reader may put up intellectual resistance to? Then you would have to probably ask probing questions or challenging questions that would motivate your reader's interest in fair consideration of your thesis. Okay? Does that help?
Yes. Yes.
Good. Any follow-up or anything you want to ask?
Yeah, I guess, would you say that you ought to try and answer the question immediately after? Because that was another thing that I had been advised to do. What would you say about it?
Well, I would steer your attention to the next section of what's at stake. So if you ask a question, you could then take those considerations of what's at stake. What if you get the answer to this question incorrectly? Or what if you're apathetic and you fail to attempt to even answer it? What's the cost? What's at stake? I don't think you have to give the reader the answer. Matter of fact, I would say you probably want to do that very rarely, because I think it would ruin the rhetorical effect of the question, because you would immediately close down the effect of the question by imposing your answer upon it. Now, what would be fun, perhaps, in a creative way, is if you raised a question and then you showed how perhaps a character in the narrative attempted an answer to that. Or maybe there's a common reading of the text that suggests an answer to that that you're in disagreement with. You could really play off that effectively. Does that make sense? If there's kind of a general consensus about how a certain text should be read in view of a question, then you could present that, but then take exception to it and challenge that commonly held interpretation of the text. So there's the creative possibilities are immense, I think, but you're doing good work already in thinking about them and what it would mean to use them. Yeah. Tiffany.
I'm wondering, in light of what you just said about questions and not answering the questions, sort of withholding us being rhetorically effective, how do you then conceive of the thesis in relationship to the question?
Right, because these questions are motivating the reader's interest in them, and so your thesis is going to be a kind of answer.
Okay, so you are thinking of the thesis, that's the
right. But I wouldn't say, ask a question, give an answer, ask a question, give an answer. Right. Because again, that closes down the reading. I honestly, as a reader, I would experience that as kind of tyrannical and kind of dismissive of my own intellectual possibilities as a reader if the author felt like they had to ask the question and then immediately answer it for me. Imagine being in a classroom discussion in a seminar environment, right, where the teacher constantly asks questions and never affords opportunity for the students to think about them and come up with their own answers. They just immediately impose an answer. That would close down discussion very quickly, I think, and be very aesthetically unpleasing. And so I would really resist doing that. Mm-hmm. Yes?
How wonderful. Thank you for these really rich ideas. I am 100% behind the advice to always be aware of what problem your papers answer. And secondly, that you don't always know what that problem is until you've gotten to the end of the paper.
That's right.
And it's what you're presenting for your reader.
Yes.
Which might be even different than the problem you have going into the paper. My question had to do with just a couple of things. First, a comment about resisting the temptation merely to paraphrase the text of your essay. And I was going to throw out the 500-pound gorilla rule, because some professors ask you to do that. And just be aware of what is being required for what professor.
Right.
Because we really do differ sometimes. I mean, I don't think fundamentally. We all want clear writing, we all want writing that's reader-friendly, we all want well-substantiated writing, we all want generally unified writing. On the other hand, people do have different requirements, and
sure.
It's always worth establishing what your professor wants for what essay you're writing.
Can I add one qualification I think would be helpful to what you just said, too? It dawns on me that in the same way that you don't want to use too long of a quote from the text in a paper because your reader doesn't exactly know what to pay attention to, I think that's the same for a paraphrase, right? If you give an extensive paraphrase, your reader doesn't always know exactly what to pay attention to in your paraphrase. So I think when you do paraphrase, just keep it condensed and interpret your paraphrase, perhaps.
Well, I think some professors actually say, I want you to put in, you know, your the the direction of your argument.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what your, and then what your essay should do is elaborate that.
Right.
And they don't care about setting up a problem. They don't want to set up a problem. Now, that might not always be the most interesting. It's handy, because if you don't have, if you don't want to read the rest of the essay,
right.
You know right there where it's going. It's a different type of essay.
Yes.
But I wanted to come back to the type of essay that gets your reader excited and wants to, cares about reading what your answer is. And I'm just wondering about the questions at the beginning. Because one of the things that's really absent from the Christopher Ricks introduction here is any examples from the text.
Well, and it's hard to tell. I try to be faithful to how it was formatted in the original, but the line there, yes, there is no good pretending, it's hard to leave everything, that's Malone's voice from one of his works. And so that is a quotation, but I think it's poorly represented in how it was particularly formatted in the published edition. I thought of preempting it and making it more clear, but that is an example of Malone's voice from one of Beckett's plays, so.
Well, even if we put quotation marks there, although that does change it, I'm wondering if it also opens up different ways of problematizing your paper. In other words, one way might be to start asking questions and to ask, you know, to think about how does this relate to larger ethical questions. But another way might be very particular. Might be to start with an example in the book,
right.
A quote, and ground your reader from the beginning in some part of the book that's really small. And I'm wondering if there are different ways. What do you see as the different varieties, so that it doesn't seem like a formula, because it might not always look like an upside down triangle.
Well, I think the general movement, because you are narrowing down to a very specific interpretive claim that you're making. And so, yeah, I didn't leave out, I mean, in the room of today's discussion, I'm just going towards what I think are essential aspects. There are endless possibilities. You can begin with a quote that might have an interpretive bearing on the text under consideration. As I said before, one of the effective ways would be to perhaps take another literary critic's interpretation of the issue that's under consideration in your thesis, and you might give their view, and then you might resist it and undermine it with your view. I think that's also very rhetorically effective, or what you're suggesting is also a great possibility, narrowing in on a very specific, perhaps, event or discourse in a text, and then expanding off of that in your interpretation. Yeah, I didn't even get into all those particularities, but I do think that questions are rhetorically effective, because they immediately solicit, even obligate, your reader's participation, and it establishes a communion of inquiry, I would describe it as, in which you're entering as a writer to a reader in a communion of querying the text, of asking important questions that are relevant not only to your understanding of the text, but human living more generally. And so maybe I have a disproportionate concern for questions. That may very well be. And again, I'm not trying to give you a cookie cutter mold, because as I point out to you, Christopher Ricks only used one question, and he didn't even use it till the very end, right before he made his thesis claim. And so there is a very creative variety in how you can use them. But I do think that much of the time, questions are going to be an essential aspect. That would be my argument. But other questions? Angela?
Where would you put background information in your introduction? Would you put that before or after any questions? Or would you establish that before or after when what's at stake? Is that what's at stake?
Wherever it's most effective. I know that may be a very generalized answer, but again, there's no prescriptive mold. This is descriptive, not heavy-handed, prescriptive. But if your reader is going to be extremely unfamiliar and you feel like you need to give some back matter, then you need to put it where it's best situated in the introduction that your reader can gain access to it. I think a lot of times we feel pressured to begin with it, but I think that's a good way to lose your reader right at the beginning, because they're gonna, none of us like to feel like we're completely in the dark, right? That is not a pleasant human experience. And so I think rhetorically, we're humans writing to humans. I think be humane in how you write, not unless you want to disorient your reader that way. I mean, there could be an occasion where you would want them. If that's what the text is doing, if the text is purposely disorienting the reader, then perhaps you could mimic or imitate that disorienting effect, but then alert your reader to that experience so that they know that it was on purpose and you didn't just set them up and are having a laugh at them at their expense. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Often the paragraph after your introduction,
yes,
is a great place to say, but first,
yes,
let me very briefly tell you all the times when Achilles does this,
yes,
just so you know what I'm going to do with it. Mm-hmm. But that often that right after the pieces, but not in your introduction, because that's if you just put it so well.
Yeah.
You don't want to know the whole background before, we don't care anymore, but
right.
You just want to know enough to care about what's at stake. And once you want to know, then you can say, especially if you signal to your reader that this is background information, the reader really appreciates that.
Absolutely.
Short, not summarizing the whole thing. Like, first, let me summarize the entire... don't do that.
Right.
But just the salient information, yes.
I tell my students all the time, use the MOM test. Your mom should be able to read your essay and get a general sense and understanding. If she can't, then it's too opaque. The mist has turned into a fog, right? The second thing is, remember too, that every paraphrase itself is an act of interpretation. So you got to be careful with that too, that you don't play too many of your valuable cards up front in the paraphrase. So as Dr. Romanek Baldwin is suggesting, be sparing there, because you don't want to give away the farm too early, right? Was there another question? Did you have one?
Yes, I did. Why does Christopher Rip, in your example highlighting how is Christopher the questions first, what does that state next in the thesis, why does he put his question?
Yeah, and again, and I'm glad that Dr. Romanek Baldwin drew attention to this. I don't mean necessarily that this is a particular prescriptive order. I do think that the thesis benefits from being in a stressed position most of the time last, but there could be a creative rhetorical effect from moving it somewhere in the introduction, right? So yes, let me clarify, and I really appreciate your question, because I don't want to be misunderstood at this point. This is not prescription, this is description of the essential elements of an introduction. But there's not a cookie cutter form. Does that make sense? And that's why I drew attention to Professor Rick's creative use of the question, because he does a very risky thing by putting it right before the thesis. But rhetorically, I think it works in his introduction. I do think it's effective, because he's had to build up to it in his introduction. Any other questions? Tiffany?
Can you speak a little bit more about the relationship between the thesis and the concluding notion?
Yes. So what you're doing is, you're framing in the introduction a problem that you find either in the text or that the text raises about human living more generally. And you need to propose a solution to that problem as a thesis. And while I think your thesis has to be a very clear, specific assertion, I feel like you need to state it in such a way that it's not tyrannical on your reader, that you're offering it to them as a suggestion, not a command, not you have to believe this, right? Because I think, again, that alienates your reader and it takes away the respect that you would give them as an intelligent reader, and also room enough to explore your argument without feeling obligated to agree with you right away. Although it should be stated in such a way that it does elicit some kind of response out of your reader. Do they have initial agreement? Do they have initial disagreement? Does it bewilder them and promote uncertainty? So the concluding notion then, as you can probably anticipate from what I just described, the concluding notion is more assertive. It is, given my analysis of the text, given the unfolding of my logical argument in the body of my paper, this is what I maintain. Right? And again, it's the most important statement. And I love, again, how Marilyn Robinson stated it, because she says, what is eternal must always be complete. Now, that's a very dogmatic assertion. It's a very clear, profound, concentrated declaration. But then she comes off of it a bit and says, if my understanding is correct. Which, if you read the whole essay, part of her argument is that theology is always speculative at best, because we don't have absolute knowledge of the divine. And so I think that works there in that way. And so there is a pressing of it, but then a coming off of it a bit to keep the open discourse between the writer and the reader effective. I don't think any of us particularly like to read essays in which we feel that they've tyrannized us, that if we don't agree with the author, that somehow we're idiots, or we're not competent readers of the text, right? Or we're barely evolved and we can't, you know, make moral decisions and that kind of thing. I just don't think that those are effective strategies for writing. I think it closes down conversation instead of opening it up and keeping it going. Does that make sense? So this is a much more emphatic declaration, distilled through the lens of your unfolding argument. Because it took all of Marilyn Robinson's essay to get us to the point where we could appreciate what she means by that very concentrated declaration, that what is eternal must always be complete. You can't just throw that out. You have to bring someone to that point, right? Yeah. Okay, well, our time is through, I believe. Thank you for your attention and your participation.